The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. It's great to be back in Philadelphia. You know, I was asked earlier this morning if I had any special connections to Philadelphia, and I thought that was such an interesting question. How could you be interested in the history of this country without having a special connection in Philadelphia? In my case, I actually grew up ages 2 to 10 not far from here in Newark, Delaware, and Philadelphia was the big city that we repaired to. And I have now developed over the decades many, many close friends, but I think we're constantly drawn here always, and I'm so happy to be back and back at the Free Library having a conversation about things I care about most, which are words and pictures. I came across a quote in the course of our research for the National Park series that I'd like to read. It's a very, very brief quote, and we actually use it at the end of our third episode. But it may help spark my own thoughts this afternoon and our own conversation, which I'm very much looking forward to. It was written in the teens or early 20s by a man named John Wesley Hill, who was an educator, a lover of books, and an ardent defender of the parks. He said, What is it that inspires love of the flag, that tunes the ear of America to sing, "My country, 'tis of thee"? Is it industrial efficiency, irrigation statistics, or trade output? Is it the hideous ore dumps of the sordid mining camp? Is it the grim powerhouse in which is harnessed Niagara? Is it the blackened waste that follows the devastation of much of our forest wealth? Is it the smoking factory of the grimy mill town, the malodorous wharves along navigable rivers? Is it even the lofty metropolitan skyscraper that shuts out the sun and throws its shadow over all below? No, our devotion to the flag is inspired by love of country. Patriotism is the religion of the soul, and national parks are its richest patrimony. I always loved that quote. I loved its sort of simplistic explanation of why the parks held a centrality. And I think I need to, in order to get into this conversation, back up a little bit more than 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I had the great good fortune to be working on a film biography of Mark Twain, to my opinion, our greatest writer. And I had the even greater good fortune to be in the Adirondack Mountains filming the novelist Russell Banks, talking about Mark Twain and talking specifically about Mark Twain's most important work, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And he was saying some amazing things about that extraordinary novel, not only as a central piece of world literature, but as a kind of barometer of who we were as American people, written when it was by the man it was written by, all the things that were caught up in the wake of its extraordinary storytelling, the voice behind the narrative. And he said, you know that it's our Iliad and our Odyssey, Huck Finn is. He said that even though most of us, and by surveying this audience, indeed most of us, share the same European ancestors as those that produced the Iliad and the Odyssey, we nevertheless, because we Americans were grappling with new themes, had to write our own. And Mark Twain, alone among writers, politicians, philosophers of the 19th century, understood what he said the two twin themes were that Americans were grappling with, unlike their European predecessors. And he was willing to engage both of these themes. Other writers like Melville had engaged one, other writers had done something else. He said, but the twin themes that Twain was grappling with in this novel particularly, but in a good deal of his work, were the things that made up this Iliad and Odyssey for us Americans, and that was race and space. I don't mean outer space. I mean the physical geography of our country. The race is obvious, and we are within a few blocks of the place where our country was born. We're one of the very few countries that knows exactly when and where we were born. And we know the creed under which we were founded. Every other country on earth is here because of geography, conquest, language, religion, race, something. And we're here because of ideas. And there is no greater refinement of those ideas than in the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence written by Thomas Jefferson, not too far from here, in which he said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." But as he wrote that sentence, which I have not completed, he happened to own more than 100 human beings, and never saw fit in his lifetime to free any of them, never saw the contradiction, never saw the hypocrisy, and set in motion an American kind of tragedy, a kind of gigantic Shakespearean play in which race has been a defining feature of it. Our first act, if you will, and let's hope that this is a grand Shakespearean drama indeed, with at least five acts. Our first act began here in Philadelphia when he wrote that sentence. He could have followed John Locke and argued for life, liberty, and property as the hallmark of a free people after the amazing statement about all men are created equal. But he didn't. He insisted on this mysterious, sort of inscrutable thing that we've been tilting towards ever since, this pursuit of happiness. Did it mean a pursuit of things in a marketplace of objects? Was it the pursuit, as I believe he meant, of happiness with a capital of H, which meant a kind of pursuits of literature and the arts, the exact reason why this extraordinary institution is here? But the tension between those impulses have been a guiding factor in an extraordinary way. But the principal thing is the setting in motion of this question about race that Thomas Jefferson did. In all of my professional life, without seeking it out consciously, I had been brought back again and again and again to the question of race. The Civil War would not have been fought had we settled the question of race. Baseball's finest moment would not have been Jackie Robinson coming up and making this so-called national pastime, in fact, in truth, what it had always claimed to be. The most important aspects of almost every film that I've worked on have, as some sort of defining moment, this question of race. And so our first act really began when Thomas Jefferson said these words, unaware of the contradiction, unmindful of all the harm that done, set in motion an American narrative that's not only been bedeviled but also ennobled by a question of race. I believe that our second act, as a student of not only history but of storytelling, our second act began on November 19, 1863. That's when Abraham Lincoln traveled to the now quiet town of Gettysburg, which had just seen the greatest battle that has ever taken place in the Western Hemisphere, to offer a few additional remarks. Now, you might remember that the featured speaker that day was Edward Everett, who spoke for more than 2 hours without notes, I might add, in these incredible jazz-like formulations that would go off. Audiences would applaud when he return back to the main tributary of his theme, appreciating quite correctly. Now, his speech was a terrific address, and the president was just going to add a couple of things. And the president spoke for 2 minutes, 269 words. The cameraman that was there to take the picture of him hadn't even had time to set up and focus before the president was walking down from the podium, and in fact, the only picture we have is of a top hat kind of disappearing into the crowd of the Gettysburg Address. But in essence, he said there, "We really do mean it. We really do mean it. All men are created equal." That American history was going to be the continual enlargement of that idea. When Thomas Jefferson, if we'd asked him, "Please, Tom, could you be more specific?" And he'd said, "Oh, sorry, I mean all white men of property free of debt. That's what I mean by all men are created equal." We would be a very different country. Instead, the very vagueness of the word sort of pulled us into our future, and each generation has continually enlarged what that means. We mean all men of all colors. We mean women. We protect our young, our elderly, the handicapped. We debate the unborn and those of different sexual preference. All of American history could in some ways be said to be the continual enlargement of that now to us rather narrow definition of Thomas Jefferson's. And so we were drawn into a second act. But for more than 100 years, nothing was really done about civil rights. It would take another 100 years and another couple generations before, I believe, and it's so interesting to be born in interesting times, to have witnessed last January 20th, the beginning of our third act as a country, in which we have been able to, in some ways, free ourselves of the baggage of the label of race. But as we can see in the way our own politics this year has metastasized, the way in which race is still an unspoken and unnamed sort of co-conspirator of vitriol in our larger dealings. And so it goes on and on. And as I said, I hope we have an opportunity to experience many more acts as a people. But this question of race will be with us and is in everything that I have done. Also in nearly everything I have done is the other theme that Twain alone among writers was willing to deal with, was willing to talk about, was willing to understand. This is a young man who headed out, like the protagonist in Huck Finn, to the territories. He lit out, escaping the specific gravity of civilization, to do what Americans had been doing since the very first Americans came here, which was moving through the landscape. It was not unusual or uncommon for our European ancestors to spend centuries, I didn't get that wrong, centuries in one place, working the same land for the same lord, living within the same narrow confines, never understanding what your world was farther than what you could see from your bedroom window. And what we Americans did is travel more or less freely, even in the lowest of classes, though we denied there were ever such things as classes, across this landscape. And so not only changed it, which is, of course, a huge, important story, moving out, in some cases exterminating original inhabitants, slaughtering wantonly the wildlife there, putting a fence post or some sort of delineation across this, but also changing ourselves as we understood what it was like to move across this thing. You know, when Thomas Jefferson, the same central figure, sent Lewis and Clark. He bought Louisiana for $15 million. It's the biggest, greatest land deal in the history of the world. It is an amazing thing to buy an empire, which is what essentially he was doing. But then he asked Congress to appropriate $2,500 to find out what 15 had bought, and sent Lewis and Clark out on, you know, an expedition that still to this day is much more central and important than the moon landing, and in some ways much more perilous. And at least you could talk to Houston all the time. These guys were gone for 2.5 years, and there was no correspondence that could reach them at any stage along the way. But Thomas Jefferson was sure when his former secretary, Meriwether Lewis, made it back and spread out his maps in the apartment, which is now the East Room of the White House, where so many of the ceremonial functions take place. That was Meriwether Lewis's apartment. He spread out the maps and showed him that, sorry, Mr. President, there's not a Northwest Passage, an easy place to put your canoe in after you've just gone over one hill at the end of the Missouri, but there's a long chain of mountains, and we're not going to find that sort of coveted holy grail of geopolitical travel that everybody thought was there, the Northwest Passage. Here is this magnificent land we have. And Thomas Jefferson was absolutely certain it would take 100 generations to fill up. That's what he thought, 100 generations. And in less than 4, we Americans had filled it up. By the time of the census of 1890, we were pretty sure there wasn't a frontier anymore. The whole very definition of who we were as a people, that is to say, living on the edge of a frontier, had disappeared. And so we began, as we had a few decades before that, to begin this sort of bittersweet process of assessing who we were and what we had become. If Mark Twain writes Huckleberry Finn after the Civil War, but talking about a pre-Civil War environment, he is commenting on how little progress we have made, is he not? If we are at the end of so-called Reconstruction, This is what the book Huckleberry Finn is about, the failure of Reconstruction, which we it comes down to us as a bad thing. Reconstruction was a good thing. It's the consequences after Reconstruction, which is the bad thing. Don't let anybody tell you we've allowed the two great works of popular cinema up to this point, Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind, would make the terrorist Knight Riders of the Ku Klux Klan the heroes of this piece. It's the other way around. This was our government's first attempt at having a civil rights program, and it was a horrible failure, and Huckleberry Finn is the response to that. At the same time, we're beginning to realize that all of these things that have defined us as a people in the physicality of our landscape are disappearing too. That if we don't do something fast, it will all be gone. And this kind of bittersweet impulse begins to enter our literature, enter our poetry, enter our mythology about who we are and what we stand for. That the bison, which used to stop trains in the 1850s for 4 or 5 hours at a time as a cloud of tens of thousands of these magnificent beasts that have come to be the symbol of the United States, had dwindled down to a handful only in the first national park set aside. We're in big trouble, and we ought to think about what else we should say. That we had this inferiority complex in the 19th century as Europeans traveling here continually belittled us. We didn't have our cathedrals. We didn't have the palaces. We didn't have the formal gardens. What did we have except this magnificent scenery? And we had made a shambles of Niagara Falls. It had become the quintessential tourist trap. It had become the place where you could expect to be swindled by the peddlers that would greet you at the railroad station and wouldn't let go of your wallet until after you got back on the train. And so we were constantly belittled. And yet at the same time, the energy released by even that flawed sentence of Thomas Jefferson's, written not a few blocks from here, would set in motion so many other things. We like to, for simplicity, define our story as being a kind of political social narrative, that is to say, a succession of presidential administrations punctured by wars. But Thomas Jefferson's words also set in a revolution in the way people worship their gods, so that almost immediately a transcendental school led by Ralph Waldo Emerson and his disciple Henry David Thoreau could suggest a new way to worship God, a kind of new sort of reformation that would permit people to worship God as they saw fit, began to take hold, and that it didn't require a dogmatic devotion in cathedrals built by man, but could happen more easily, they felt, by seeing God's handiwork in nature. This is the essence of it. And wildness is a necessity, Thoreau said. And so the story of America becomes the next step is to, you see in our arts, begins to mirror this, the Hudson River and later the Rocky Mountain schools. And what do we paint? The thing that we have in abundance, which is scenery. And then all of a sudden somebody says, we ought to save these places. We ought to set aside the Awanichi's beautiful valley in the Sierra Mountains, which the first intruders mistook to be called Yosemite, which actually means they are killers, referring to the people who are trying to figure out what the name of the tribe is they've come to dispossess, not even stopping to know what the tribe was, the Awanichi's beautiful valley, which they called Awani, Yosemite. Or this incredible place, Coulter's Hell. It was called the first defector from the Lewis and Clark journey as they were beginning to meet with civilization going down the Missouri River on their return trip home, in which they lost only one person, one man. John Coulter said, don't think so, and headed back up the Missouri and came across this place where mud boiled and geysers went off and described it. Nobody believed, and nobody believed Joe Meeks or Jim Bridger, the other mountain men who returned. Another expedition followed in the 1860s, and nobody believed them. They sent their findings to Lippincott's magazine, and they said, sorry, we don't print fiction. And it took finally the United States government and a scientific expedition that brought along photographers and painters as well to finally show that this place, Yellowstone, did exist and was set aside accidentally as the world's first national park. I said accidentally because we had taken
Yosemite and set it aside. For the first time in human history, large tracts of natural land were not given to kings or noblemen or the very rich, but to everybody and for all time. It had never happened before in the history of exchange in all land before. But then we thought, we're a states' rights kind of country. Still, it's 1864, the Civil War. We'll give it to California to take care of. Eventually, it came back into the fold. But 8 years later, in 1872, when Yellowstone was set aside, there was no entity to give it to. It was in Wyoming and Idaho and Montana territory. There was no entity to give it to. So sort of with a shrug of shoulder, not like the great fireworks that John Adams suggested take place every July 4th when we celebrate that second sentence of the Declaration of Independence, written here, not so far away in Philadelphia, they said, okay, it'll be a national park. We won't appropriate anything for it. Naturally, this is Congress's great, this is the original unfunded mandate. And it set in motion this amazing thing. When we heard Russell Banks say that startling word to us about our Iliad and our Odyssey, my partner on that film, Dayton Duncan, and I just looked at each other with a kind of exhilaration that one feels as if your own mail had been stolen, your own diary read, and yet the reader had read back to you the very soul of who you were and what you were about. That all of our lives we had been investigating these twin themes of race and space without doing so consciously, didactically, or politically correctly, but doing it organically and authentically, because that's what the story of America is, that we could look at suddenly and have our own lives in a way contained in the thoughtfulness of this very great contemporary writer, and realize then that we had to do something on the national parks. We had explored this question of space in the West and in Lewis, in a film on Lewis and Clark and Thomas Jefferson, and we're doing it in Mark Twain and many, many other films. But now we had to go to the national parks because that's where the apotheosis of this idea of space comes in. That there are no other places in the world where any of us here can go and look and see it, not only as John Muir saw it 150 years ago, or Thomas Jefferson might have been able to see it 200 years ago, but the ancestors of the Awanichi Indians could have seen 7 or 8,000 years ago. There is nothing on this planet that remains that so centrally unchanged, and that the fact that we have had the good fortune as a people to set it aside and to preserve it in this magnificent system is a testament to us, and like the idea of liberty, has itself grown and expanded. So we found that working on a history of the national parks was, in fact, a parallel history to the larger history of the United States. We started out by saving obvious scenery, the highest free-falling waterfall on the continent at Yosemite, the greatest collection of geothermal features, geysers, on the planet, the grandest canyon on Earth. These were things that we set aside, but then all of a sudden we began to set aside places of antiquity, archaeological sites that showed the ancient Puebloan culture that thrived and then mysteriously disappeared more than 1,000 years ago. We began to set aside, at the time of our depression, we began to aggregate all the important battlefields of our political and military history into this National Park Service. We invented in 1916 a National Park Service. Up until then, these were just existed as sort of wards of the Department of Interior. Suddenly we had an agency to take care of them. Suddenly we had superintendents, and more importantly, these wonderful beings called rangers to superintend them even more directly. We began to set aside a more complicated vision of America that just didn't embrace its spectacular scenery or its archaeological sites or its battlefields, even took in complex environments and habitats that didn't quite look at first blush like they rated a national park. But if you've ever been to the Everglades, the only place in the world where crocodiles and alligators coexist, a place of startling diversity, perhaps the most diverse variety of plant and animal life on the planet, you are suddenly made aware of what scenery means in a different sort of thing, that you begin to collect things based on their wilderness potentials. That is to say, by the time of the Second World War, we're setting aside places where there will be no roads, there will be no restrooms, there will be no visitor centers. It will be just as it was. We began to use complex ecological and environmental metrics to gauge what is and what isn't an effective place. And that we've also set aside places of shame that reflect the other side of that history. So in addition to magnificent plantations, we have also saved the slave cabins that made the comfortable life of that plantation owner possible. We've saved Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. It's still a working inner city high school. It's also a unit of the National Park Service. We've saved Washita and Sand Creek on the Great Plains, where Black Kettle's peaceful Cheyenne villages were raided by U.S. cavalrymen and many, many scores of people massacred. We've saved Manzanar, where Japanese-American citizens were interned during the Second World War when no German Americans or Italian American citizens were so interned. We saved Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma City, and a number of other sites in the idea that a great country could acknowledge a complicated past and be better. I mean, I know of no country on earth that does that with such startling honesty. And so I think we came to see, as the writer Wallace Stegner said, that the national parks were our best idea. He said, his words specifically, were the best idea we've ever had. And if those of you have had a chance to see even parts of the 12 hours of our film, well, we could show it now. You'll be out by 1 a.m. If you've seen any bit of it, you know that the first time we introduced that idea of Stegner's, that we immediately debated, and someone comes on, an extraordinary historian named Clay Jenkins, said, it's not the best idea. The best idea comes from Thomas Jefferson, who says, regardless of the accident of your birth, ... And so I hope that in some ways, in my brief comments now, I've closed a circle not only for the most recent film that we've shared with you, but for indeed the animating spirit behind all of the work that we've done over the last 35 years. And I look forward with great excitement to a conversation that we can have starting now. There are people who, I think there are two microphones, and they will be roaming the aisles. And I won't call on you until you've got a microphone in your hand, but please don't be shy. Raise your hand and let's spend the next few minutes together. This woman on the aisle here.
Hi. First of all, I want to, I guess, give a shout out. I'm a master's student at University of Delaware in Newark, so you might be familiar with that.
I am indeed.
I'm actually currently in a class called Global Environmental History, and we've spoken about your film plenty, and we're very excited to watch, admittedly not all 12 hours of it, but a topic that is very much recurring in our class, as well as in the books that we've been reading, is the idea of humans apart from nature, rather than being a part of it, one with nature, that kind of idea. You mentioned transcendentalists, and George Perkins Marsh mm-hmm. wrote Man and Nature back in the 1860s, kind of touching on that idea as, or the question, rather, are men apart from nature? I was also pleasantly surprised to see that you welcomed William Cronin as well as other environmental historians in to comment in your film, and so that was very refreshing to get those comments.
I think that there is a casualty of civilization that Emerson understood and is part of the transcendental movement, is that the very nature of civilization is going to remove us from contact with nature. I don't know what your experience is, but my mother pushed me out of the house early in the morning and said, be home by lunch, pushed me out of the house and said, be home by dinner when the streetlights came on. And kids now are completely supervised. They spend, you know, something like 7 to 8 hours a day in front of a terminal of some kind, a TV set or a computer terminal or some handheld device. And we understand now the incredible penalties of a disconnect from nature. But we have within our system created these places where it's very possible to be touched by it. And the word you used at the beginning of your comment was part of. And every single interview we did, someone said at least 10 times, a part of it. It made me feel connected. It made me feel part of it. John Muir talked about a kinship that comes from this essential paradox that as I stand on the rim of that grandest canyon on earth, whose Colorado River exposes Precambrian Vishnu schist that is 1.7 billion years old, nearly half the age of the planet, I think on my own 80 years, four score that I get, and feel pretty small and insignificant. And yet you're made larger by that, just like the egotist in our midst is diminished by his or her self-regard. We are enlarged by the humility we feel that only nature permits. And I think it was in that spirit. Every single one of the 50 or 60 people that we introduced to you, the historical figures, had some point at which they realized that these wild places performed a kind of open heart surgery on them that made them available to something higher. Theodore Roosevelt talked about the higher emotions of the human race. That's what we all look for. It's not in, certainly not in sentimentality and nostalgia, but it's certainly not in the rational world most of us spend our times retreating to for the safety of the precision of things, that one and one equals two, when in fact all we want is for one and one to equal three. That's what we look for all the time in everything, that the whole be greater than the sum of its parts. That's what we're asking. In the parks, we were surprised uniformly among those 60 people did that. And all of the people, Cronin included, had to not only help us tell it, but insisted on them telling us their own personal stories of when they were opened up. And we, in turn, if we were honest about our experiences over 10 years of working on that film, had to say that each one of us had had that kind of transcendental experience, that transformative moment, call it whatever you want, spiritual, religious, scientific, that rearranged our molecules, in which 1 + 1 = 3, the only thing we really want. And that was a hugely important part of our process.
Thank you.
Somebody, yes, sir, on the aisle. Here comes the...
Your work certainly enhances the treasures that we have, and I think that's probably widely thought of. Could you give us an idea as to the rhythm of your filming, why you selected certain sites, the timing during the seasons of the year to capture this work?
Yeah, you know, what we want to say, thank you, what we want to say, first of all, is that a good story is the opposite of an encyclopedia. Do you know what I mean? Where I'm always thrilled when you make an 18 and a half hour film on baseball or jazz and people immediately say, well, this is what you left out. You go, whew, you know. You look for symbolic and emblematic stories, signal stories that sort of fit in for everything else. So in our series, the history begins when the Mariposa Battalion in 1851 marches in to this beautiful valley in the Sierras intent on dispossessing the native peoples there, i.e. getting rid of them, burning their villages, and perhaps killing them. California is a place where sanctioned, licensed genocide took place. Most of the other Indian connections are specific battles or massacres back and forth or disease. But California, we actually put a bounty on the heads of other human beings, and that's genocide. And it's a terrible, terrible story. So Yosemite and Yellowstone, the first national park, a priori have to be part of that. Our filming process was to therefore not feel compelled to list everyone, but to go through the central emotional stories and the main characters that are the through line of the thought, the development of the thought of the story. And as such, we felt compelled to go to these places in every time of day and every season, look at them strained from every vantage and every time of day to look at what they were telling to us, to collect equally in another parallel thing all the archives available, because we can just as easily and sometimes more easily tell a story through the archival material, in this case mostly still photographs, than anything that the live cinematography does. And if you've ever seen a documentary where you suddenly realize that you're looking at some very pretty pictures, but they seem to be what we would call in music vamping, that they were just marking time, that they weren't really doing anything but offering an image to show while somebody talked, we try very hard to eschew that. Meanwhile, we're also writing, unconcerned with what the right hand is doing. The left hand is writing a script that's interested in some stories and doesn't know whether there'll be pictures to show it. And we, too, are not constrained by our own shooting, wondering whether this is going to work for some scene. In fact, we end up having a much more vigorous editing period than anyone else I know because we are so corrigible to the end. And one of the great casualties in filmmaking is the word. Word often becomes subservient or is at least at all times a competitor and in some cases the enemy of what you do. The great benefit of this kind of process is the word actually is strengthened, that we care so very much about words. In the beginning is the word that as our drafts, no longer the written in stone template that has us have our heads buried while we're shooting and buried while we're editing in the script and following nothing else, the fact that it's open to revision and change and rewrite constantly and constantly actually strengthens the power of those words and treats our audience, we think, permits us to treat our audience with intelligence rather than the classic expression in an editing room is the initials LCD. That's what we think about you. The lowest common denominator. That's how people edit. And we sort of completely reject that. We're interested in sort of aiming high, that to reward second and third viewings, but not with that intentionally, but to say that you might be permitted to synthesize. You don't need to point arrows at things. And the process, look, I told someone, a reporter earlier, I've got the best job in the country. I really do believe that. I'm willing to have someone contradict me by saying they have the best job in the world. I'm very happy to hear that someone might feel that, but I do genuinely think that. And a lot of it comes from this adherence to a process that's not governed by a lot of the decisions that govern other processes of filmmaking. Yes, sir.
What would be the one place you would like to go of all if you can't go to all these other places?
Of the national parks?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's so funny. Isn't that a corollary of what's your favorite national park? And what we found is that it was like your own children, impossible to decide, that each one that you've been to, there are 58 natural national parks out of a system that has now 392 units. I think we just have a new unit. So that means 334 are these historical sites, monuments, wild and scenic places, national recreation areas, seashores, independent, small, all of those different things. But of the 58 national parks, if you get to a lot of them, as I have, or all of them, as Dayton Duncan, my co-producer and writer of this series, has, it then becomes very, very hard to decide it. So what you do is you fall back on your own personal history. I grew up, as I said, not too far from here in Newark, Delaware. When I began this project, we worked for several years sort of organizing, and then we went filming. We started filming early in the spring of 2003. This project has been going on for more than 10 years and shooting. And the first full-fledged national park that I went to was Yosemite. And I had told my compatriots that I thought that this was the first national park I'd been to. I'd been to a lot of battlefields and historical sites, but this was it. How lucky was I, and how lucky was I? We were in Yosemite National Park, and I worked for two or three or four days, you know, 18-hour days. It was exhilarating. It's gorgeous. And the last night, we were going to get up early and go back to San Francisco, and I should have fallen into this deep and peaceful sleep, and I couldn't. And what had happened is that Yosemite had sort of awakened something in me, and I suddenly realized in the middle of the night, frustrated that I couldn't go to sleep, wondering why I was physically exhausted, I realized it was not the first national park I'd ever been to. That in 1959, when I was 6 years old, my mother was dying of cancer just down the road in Newark. Our household, as you can imagine, was a grim and demoralized place. My father was not a very good father. You know, catches in the backyard were few and far between. Attendance at my baseball games, non-existent. One Friday afternoon, he took me from school. We drove to Baltimore, where he had grown up, put me to bed in his old bedroom, in his old bed, under his old chenille comforter at my grandmother's house. And it was 1 second later that he was leaning over me, waking me up in the middle of the night and said, okay, let's get going. And I'd never gotten up that early. I'd never left the house in the darkness before in my life. And we drove pre-interstate system to Front Royal, Virginia, which is the top of the Skyline Drive. And all of a sudden, lying there in Yosemite in 2003, my father dead a year and a half, I could suddenly remember, my mother dead nearly 40 years, I could suddenly remember what my father's hand was in mine, what it felt like in mine. I remember what I wore. I remember him scattering deer with his car horn. I remember going through a cloud. I remember going through a tunnel. I'd never done that. We checked into a cabin. We went on this impossibly long hike of a mile and a half. We kicked over logs and caught orange-red salamanders and let them go, and my father identified every tree and every stump. That's my favorite park, wouldn't it be? That's the essence. I think it's the emotional archaeology that's at the heart of it. We're not looking for a history that's interested in dry dates and facts and events, but some kind of emotional archaeology that makes those events and dates and stuff have meaning. And for me, you then begin to say, it's what has meaning personally for you then becomes the best place. So Yosemite and Shenandoah are these twin. I mean, Shenandoah is a relatively minor park compared to the glories of Yosemite, but to me, they are forever paired. If you ask my partner on this, he'll say Glacier, not because Glacier is that much more beautiful than any place. It's spectacular, and I've been to Glacier, and it's amazing, but that's where he courted his wife, and that's where he brought back. That's where he was taken as a young boy on his only vacation. That's where he courted his wife, and that's where he brought his wife and the fruits of their courtship back many years later that initiated this project. And so it goes on. And that's what we found from people as objective as William Cronin, this great historian, who needed to tell us about his father taking him to parks. That we since the Civil War series came out in 1990, we have been stunned by the response to this series in just the couple of months since it was broadcast. The people who stop you and just want to tell you about their parents taking them or how they went or they just got back from their kids or they're now going to take, they were going to Europe, but they're going to the national parks. One woman came up to the last book signing I did with a hand truck with 19 books saying, all my Christmas shopping, and wanted to give the same book to everybody in her family, sort of the Bible of travel, you know, to get out to go to these parks.
Is there a unit to be discovered?
Is there a unit to be discovered? Yes, there are. I mean, if you think about it, in 1980, where our film ends, we more than doubled the size of the national parkland. And I mean national parkland, not just national park units, national park land with the addition of the Alaska stuff. We'll always be finding a historical moment, a person's homestead that has meant something to us, a rediscovered recess of a darker past that we feel we're strong enough to be able to deal with. We'll be able to elevate some of those monuments to full-fledged park status, take some of the national forests, which are part of the Agriculture Department, read crop, and move it to the Interior Department and the National Park Service to save and preserve them forever. So there's always work to do. And I think given the fact that when our third act began, if you accept my theory, last January 20th, the current president inherited a backlog of maintenance that had been neglected of nearly, some people say, $8 billion, money that should have been spent on keeping those roads, keeping those camping facilities, keeping those visitor centers up and running. So you can imagine the kind of work in terms of restoration, as the writer Terry Tempest Williams says in the last gulp of our film, that is necessary. So maybe even our ideas of what a new unit might be could change, that it might be sometimes we look within ourselves to fix things up, to heal things. And I think a good deal of that needs to take place and already has. We've added, since January 20th, 2 million acres. Not bad. Yes?
Hi, I'm a professor of tourism at Drexel University, and these are my great students right here. They want
to... Yeah, better start that again for the public record here.
Okay, yes, I'm a professor of tourism at Drexel University, and these are my students who've come to listen to you today here in the first second and third row. You've touched something that's very interesting to me. You probably know the topic Black Hills, White Justice, and that the Native American presence on national parks is something that I think is quite small. I wonder if you could talk, and you talked about the Uwani and Yellowstone. Could you talk about perhaps integrating back the national Native American presence into national parks?
Yeah, it's been done in Alaska. That's the good news, that with the addition of all the lands in Alaska, the Native American population was included not as they had been in earlier times as sort of tourism emblems, but in fact subsistence species within a national park. And it was, of course, as you can imagine, a very touchy debate. We ourselves as filmmakers have spent most of our lives trying to remind people of the Native American part of this story. And in fact, every single park that we introduce you to, we start off by telling you not just the ancient geological history, but what tribe or tribes of people, and you mentioned Black Hills. One of my closest friends and one of the greatest wonders and ironies of this world is that the superintendent of Mount Rushmore National Monument is a man named Gerard Baker, who is a Mandan and Hidatsa Indian, and he gets to interpret every day for the tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people who stream to Mount Rushmore, one of the most emblematic and symbolic things, the complete story of the Black Hills and of the Native peoples, and has, as has been done in many other places in the continental United States, brought back the tribes to experience the fact that as tragic and as violent and as horrific, beginning with the expulsion of the Awanichis from their beautiful valley, Awani, Yosemite to us, that these are still places that are more or less how they were when they were expelled, or when we discovered them. And there's possibilities there, and I think you're finding an Interior Department and a Park Service and specific parks really disposed to that complicated past. Yes.
What is your next project?
I am actually, you're looking at one of the most foolish people on earth. I am currently working on 6 projects right now. I'd be pregnant all the time if I were the opposite sex. We in 1994, we came out with a 9-part, 9-inning history of baseball. We thought that baseball was more than just the box score, won and loss. It was a really good mirror of America. So we are updating that with what we're calling a 10th inning. That will come out next year. We are in the middle of editing a 3-part, 6-hour series on the history of Prohibition, that great... It's basically so we could invent the phrase unintended consequences. You know, we talk about government in our lives today. When the government regulated this human behavior that had been going on for centuries, it has unintended consequences. And our film actually begins a century before Prohibition and tells about all the very interesting political steps that led up to it. We're also working on a more recent, what we call contemporary history, on the Central Park jogger case. You remember in April of 1989, a young person who worked for Solomon Brothers was brutally raped and left for dead in Central Park, and that 5 boys, Black and Hispanic, were arrested for wilding. And even the most liberal of columnists were for throwing these animals, as they were called, into cages and throwing away the keys. And it turns out they didn't do it. And they served out their full terms without parole or anything else, and they didn't do it. And we know who did it. And we're making a film about that, Back to Race and Space. We just got back from the panhandle of Oklahoma and Texas and the surrounding environments of New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, and Nebraska to do a complicated history of the Dust Bowl, that great man-made ecological catastrophe superimposed over the greatest economic catastrophe in the history of the world. And those folks who still remember what happened are alive and need to be recorded before they disappear. I've just finished this last week filming interviews for a history of the Roosevelts. You know, people do Theodore Roosevelt or they do Franklin and sometimes Franklin and Eleanor, but all 3 of them were born Roosevelts, a part of a much larger, complicated family, and they controlled the White House for 19 of the first 45 years and reminded us in very, very different ways of the possibility of government. It's unfortunate now that our debate has, since about 1980, been changed, not to my version of government is better than yours, but that government is bad in and of itself. you know, and you have to stop and give pause and think Declaration of Independence, Constitution, Bill of Rights, land-grant colleges, Homestead Act, Emancipation Proclamation, national parks, antitrust laws, Social Security. Everybody for giving up your Social Security? GI Bill. Anybody here benefit from the GI Bill? Space program, civil rights legislation, interstate highway system. I mean, it's just one bad thing after another from this government. One bad thing after another. And up until Theodore Roosevelt took the presidency, with the exception of wars and Abraham Lincoln's example, our government was about not being involved in people's lives in a positive way. And Theodore Roosevelt rearranged that, and then Franklin Roosevelt did it even more extensively. And how is it that people to the manor born who knew what security is would have in their own deep psychological underpinnings the absence of security, each one of them, Theodore, Franklin, and Eleanor, in different ways that would so not metastasize, but the opposite, transform it into the idea of security for everybody. Theodore Roosevelt proposed health care. He proposed a version of Social Security, living wage. Theodore Roosevelt felt in 1912 when he ran on the Bull Moose Party that everybody, one person in the family, should have a job that should support everybody else in the family. That communist. We're also doing a history of Vietnam. Yeah, right. And that's a complicated thing. It was a journalistic thing done at the beginning of the 80s, but we will be in 2015, 40 years from the fall of Saigon, and that's time to really think about what happened. And before those then young men pass from the scene, as the veterans of our World War II film 2 years ago were able to give us just a glimpse into what it's like. I mean, each generation, because it is so horrible to be in war, immediately sort of envelops it in bloodless, gallant myth, and so we don't have a chance to actually be reminded of what actually happens in war, ever. And so we make them into these glorious human enterprises, which then we jump into. And we think of the Vietnam generation as being much more voluble than the reticent greatest generation. And it's just not true. We are in a much more therapeutic time, and people do talk more, but they don't talk about what happens in battle. Nobody does. It took us, we did 650 interviews, 47 on camera, and four or five of those people for World War II actually said what was going on to see somebody having their head blown off next to them, or some such similar kind of thing. And if you don't remember, and you don't understand, a good friend of mine is traveling around army installations with readings from the Greek plays about war, in which people come home and they go postal and they drink themselves to death and they kill themselves or they kill their wives or they kill their best friends or they kill some stranger. Has been going on since then. And, you know, basically the experience is the same. I was scared. I was bored. I was hot. I was cold. I don't think my officers knew what they were doing. I didn't have the right equipment. I saw bad things. I did bad things. I lost good friends. Those nine declarative sentences are common to every single war that I know. And yet we never remember that. And we have an opportunity, obviously, in some ways an obligation to try to bore down and obviously tell the larger narrative of what happened, both here at home in the war against the war and in the actual war itself, but also to be able to pull back enough direct human experience of combat that we understand what the cost is. Because particularly in a government in which all men are created equal, you do have an ability to try to influence the decisions of whether we send people off to war. And we ought to be able to exercise that with the full understanding of what the consequences are. So, hence Vietnam. Yes, one more? Sir? Yes.
It obviously takes a substantial number of people to work with you. I'm just... I was hoping that you'd be able to tell us how do you go about assembling the kind of people that you need, the skills and competencies that they have, and the degree to which they share your passion with the various topics that you tackle.
how fortunate I am to have your question, because I think one of the great mythologies of a circumstance like this is that this is a Ken Burns film, and you watch the hundreds of names go by if you're still there at the credits and marvel perhaps at how one puts together this. I have the great good fortune to work with some extraordinary people. Each one of these films, though, is sort of handmade by about a dozen. While there are hundreds of people involved and have their hands on it at one time or another, it's made not by legions, but by four or five or six editors and assistant editors, a writer, myself, and a couple of producers or co-producers, and that's about it. And we don't have legions of researchers. We don't have researchers, because I would not want to send somebody to the Free Library of Philadelphia that I hadn't worked with for dozens of years. Because if that person came back, traditionally the researcher is the lowest rung in the production ladder, and they said, oh, there were 1,000 photographs here, and here's Xerox's of 500, I'd lie awake wondering what the other 500 are. And even now, I find from people I've worked with for 30 years, I'd say, you got that one and not that one? So it's all very much a passionate thing of people that are very, very committed. We live in a tiny village in New Hampshire. All of them have, for the most part, all but a couple have moved there, and the other two are in New York City, and spend a lot of time up there, and we really just focus. We bear down and spend as much time as we can sort of hand shaping them. And I think passion is the word. Monday doesn't feel like a bad day to me, and Friday isn't a relief. The people that I work with are my closest friends, and that's something I'd wish for everybody. I mean, that's been the joy of struggling to tell these stories. And I want to tell you, they are all struggles, and being in public television, it's very tough to raise the money to do it, and all of it is friction and uphill. I could easily move to HBO and have all the budgets for the films, but then they'd say, oh, we don't want you to do Jack Johnson. Unforgivable Blackness? You're going to make a film called Unforgivable? That won't sell. And they'd have the final word, and they would own it, and you would just feel in some ways like it wasn't your own. So we submit it. We reinvent the wheel of fundraising every single time, but we end up feeling like we don't need a director's cut when the DVD comes out. Do you know what I mean? That we haven't said, here's what somebody... I have A-list Hollywood friends, directors that you would recognize. And we sit around and have a meal, and invariably you say, boy, I really like that film. And they say, oh, that executive producer hated me. I never got the music I wanted. I wanted to use this guy. I wanted to use this person. I wasn't able to do this. She wasn't available, so I had to use her. He was such a pain in the neck in that production. We had to do this. If I'd been able to use this extra money, which they wouldn't give me for this scene, and I'm sitting there going, that hasn't happened to me. Another way of saying it, and a good way to end, is to say that if you don't like any of my films, it's all my fault, which is the way I want it to be, you know. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.